At this point, we've seized quite a few items that still have to be searched. I have a detective and two officers working with Kate full-time.
A Ketchikan City Council member has been arrested on child pornography charges. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, November 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new idea to get a gas line in Alaska.
I guess what this signals is increasing frustration, you might even call it desperation, on the part of Alaskans who are saying, give me a pipe, any pipe, get something done.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. November is National Family Caregivers and Alzheimer's Awareness Month. Are you one of the thousands of Alaskans who provide care for a family member who is chronically ill, elderly, or has a disability? Where there are resources and help for you and your loved one. For information, visit alaskaaging.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Aging and the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority.
Ketchikan City Council member Jack Shea resigned today after being arrested Friday night on 10 counts of possession of child pornography. As KRBD's Deanna Garrison reports, Shea is a former mayor of both the Ketchikan Gateway Borough and City of Ketchikan. He also served as the former head of the State Division of Employment Security and is a past president of the Alaska Municipal League.
A worker at a computer repair shop contacted Ketchikan police Friday afternoon about images reportedly found on Jack Shea's computer. Deputy Police Chief Josh Dossett.
Mr. Shea had brought in his computer to have some work on it. It was having problems printing. The tech put the printer and the computer together and turned them on. And when they were hooked up and turned on, the printer began printing out pictures that were already queued in the computer. Several of those pictures were of child pornography.
Dossett says police officers subsequently obtained a warrant allowing them to search Shea's computer and residence. He says the search took place Friday evening.
At this point, we're still sorting through it. We have found additional pictures at the residence that appear to be of prepubescent kids in sexual acts. Child pornography can be stored on multiple different media at this point. I mean, they can be videos, they can be on computer, they can be printed out. At this point, we've seized quite a few items that still have to be searched. I have a detective and two officers working with Kate full-time. They're basically working their way through the different media.
Dossett says printed child pornographic images were found on top of a printer in the home office at Shea's residence. Charging documents filed in court describe 10 photos of children as young as toddlers engaged in a variety of sexual acts. 80-year-old Shea was arrested at his home at around 10:30 Friday night. He was arraigned in Ketchikan Superior Court Saturday morning. Shea pled not guilty and was released on $30,000 bail. City Mayor Lou Williams III says Shea resigned from the Ketchikan City Council Monday morning.
I called Jack this morning. He informed me that due to the circumstances, he thinks it's best to resign from the council.
Williams says he was shocked by the child pornography charges.
It's a surprise for everybody. I told him I'd be thinking of him, I'd be praying for him, and I hope everything works out.
Shea is one of, if not the most well-known figures in Ketchikan. He has been steeped in Ketchikan's political establishment, serving as mayor of both the city and borough, as well as serving on the borough assembly, school board, and city council. He was one of the founders of First City Players and was named the Grand Marshal of the community's 4th of July parade in 2003. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
Senator Mark Begich cited his frustration at the lack of progress on getting an Alaska natural gas pipeline built as he introduced legislation today in Washington. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Senator Begich's bill would boost prospects of a so-called stub-to-hub line, that is, a shorter pipeline stub that could be built from the North Slope to a hub like Fairbanks, with the plan of eventually extending the line from there. As it is, there are federal benefits such as loan guarantees and expedited permitting timelines, but only for a gas line that reaches the Canadian border. Senator Begich's bill would give those same incentives to a gas line that only goes part way, with the eventual plan of getting gas to outside markets.
The idea here is to ensure that as the state kind of reconsiders how it's focused on a gas line, that we still put into place some opportunities that the federal government will have to have in this process. One is to expedite the regulatory process, to streamline the regulatory process, to kind of cut the red tape so whatever gas line they decide to move forward on, that the federal government's not going to be blocking it or be the stumbling block in getting it to market.
Senator Begich's bill would also give the Federal Pipeline Coordinator's Office a role in working on a smaller gas project. Right now, that D.C. and Anchorage-based office can only help with a gas line headed to Canada. Federal Coordinator Larry Persily says as long as FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, sees a smaller stub project inside Alaska as leading to an eventual bigger project, his office could have a role.
Gives them more options. It says if you're only going to build part of it, but the Federal Commission says eventually it will be part of the entire project, you can get the benefits, even if it's a smaller project, even if it's only half a project.
Persily says he doesn't see this as a signal that hopes of a gas pipeline through Canada to the lower 48 are diminishing. He says that's still the goal, but Persily says he is sensing that Alaskans and their political leaders are grasping at whatever they can to move things forward.
I guess what this signals is increasing frustration, you might even call it desperation, on the part of Alaskans who are saying, give me a pipe, anywhere, any size, give me a piece of steel that holds gas, get something done.
Last week, some members of Senator Begich's Democratic Party called for a halt to federal subsidies for oil and gas companies as a way to save money, and told APRN that they would not support more financial incentives for an Alaska gas line project. But Begich says the loan guarantees aren't the highest priorities in his bill. He says expediting the process and having regulatory certainty are more important.
That is the ultimate. At the end of the day, if we can, knock down these regulations, get it focused on bringing the product to market, that's what I'm going to be highly focused on. So if they have heartburn over one piece, we'll deal with that. But at the end of the day, I hope these folks, as they get into their big SUVs and head home tonight or flip on their power switch to light up their house, that they think about where that's all coming from.
Senator Begich isn't confining his focus to what Washington can do to get a gas line moving. In September, he wrote to Governor Sean Parnell encouraging the state to look at creating its own loan guarantee to give some incentive to the project. That might get more attention if Congress balks at expanding the federal loan guarantees. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
The U.S. Army has charged an Alaska-based soldier with attempted espionage, issuing false statements, and other counts. Specialist William Colton Millay was charged today through the military justice system. Army officials say no classified information was ever transmitted by Millay and that the 22-year-old military police officer was being observed before any damage could have occurred. Officials have said there is no connection with the case involving Army analyst Bradley Manning, who is suspected of disclosing secret intelligence to WikiLeaks. Millay's October 28th arrest at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage stems from an investigation by the Army and FBI. Millay is assigned to the 164th Military Police Company. Most company members were deployed to Afghanistan in March, but Millay was in the company's rear detachment that stayed behind. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a hydroelectric dam near Kodiak is in danger of collapsing.
If the dam were to fail, not only would there not be any water supply to the generator any longer, the flood wave would knock out the generator building.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
The city of Uzinki near Kodiak is working quickly to prevent their 25-year-old wooden dam from collapsing. Extensive rot was discovered on the Mahuna Dam earlier this summer, and further inspections have shown that it could collapse at any time. KMXT's Jenny Canfield reports.
The dam provides drinking water and affordable electricity for the 161 year-round residents of the community. Charles Cobb is the state dam safety engineer for the Department of Natural Resources. Cobb was first to inspect the dam earlier this year. He says a collapse could be devastating.
the hydroelectric generators just downstream of the dam. I mean, it's a good ways, but it is in the drainage. And so if the dam were to fail, not only would there not be any water supply to the generator any longer, it would the flood wave would knock out the generator building.
The state requires all dams to be inspected every 3 to 5 years, depending on their classification. The dam was last inspected in 2007 and should have been inspected again in 2010, but it wasn't. He says the owners, in this case the city of Uzinki, are responsible for hiring engineers to conduct inspections.
So I was just following up on the overdue inspection and encouraged the mayor to get an engineer to look at it, and he did. That's when we discovered that the problem was much more substantial than it was, you know, several years ago.
The dam was built in 1986 and improved 10 years later. It had a 20-year life expectancy, according to Uzinki City Mayor Dan Clarion. Clarion says the hydropower plant houses several $100,000 worth of new equipment that was recently purchased with money from the Denali Commission. And without the hydropower generator, the city would have to rely on diesel generators that would likely double or triple energy costs. If the city can get the water level down from 13 feet to about 4 or 5 feet, Clarion says damage will be limited.
Yeah, we're kind of on borrowed time right now. The recommendations by DNR is that we dewater the dam, keep it as low as we can, and still be able to maintain our water system and our hydro system.
Clarion added that their salmon stream is in the drainage and would also be damaged if the dam collapsed at full capacity. Right now, the city is hurrying to install a new valve that would help bring the water level down and allow for further drainage in case of heavy precipitation. Engineers are trying to figure out the lowest water level at which the dam can still operate. Until the new valve is installed, Cobb says the dam can only lose water through the hydropower generator.
If it rains faster than they can generate electricity, so to speak, it'll fill back up again to the spillway level. And that's where we have some concerns. When it's high enough to spill out of the spillway, that's a full load on the dam, and it definitely raises concerns.
As for a backup plan for drinking water, the city is working to rehabilitate an old infiltration gallery set up at the river. Still, if the dam collapses before the water level is significantly decreased, it could take that out as well. Clarion says with any luck, the new valve should be operable within the month. Structural repairs to the dam are still being considered, although the fixes would be temporary. The city has applied to the Alaska Energy Authority for money from their Renewable Energy Fund that would help pay for a design plan and the survey work required for dam permitting. The city still needs to find an estimated $6 million to replace their crumbling dam. That could take a few years. In Kodiak, I'm Jennifer Canfield.
The newest addition to the state's prison system, Goose Creek Correctional Center, will receive inmates next spring. The facility, located about 9 miles from Port McKenzie in the Matanuska-Susitna Borough, relies less on innovation than on the tried and true, according to Alaska Corrections Commissioner Joe Schmidt. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer toured the new prison recently and brings us this report.
Were it not for the rolls of razor wire atop the 12-foot double fences surrounding the prison, the spanking new facility could be mistaken for a high school campus, complete with grassy lawns, paved walkways, and a basketball court. Corrections Commissioner Joe Schmidt led a group of reporters through the main gate and across the now snow-spattered grass to a typical housing unit for the medium-security prisoners that will make up the majority of the inmates.
So we try to take steps when we build and operate a facility to stop institutionalization.
Schmidt says the idea is to encourage prisoners to rely on themselves for basic day-to-day tasks. The facility has been designed with that aim, with dining hall, medical clinic, even a post office aligned in separate units a short walk from the housing area. Inside the housing units, vivid blue doors on the tiny 80-foot square cells stand in contrast to the blank white walls and shiny aluminum-hued cots bolted in bunk bed style within each cell. There are 10 units with 128 beds each that will house the general prison population.
That's 10 different opportunities for us to group prisoners together. One thing we started a few years ago is it's called housing by custody. So if you're a medium or minimum offender, you can live in the same cell. So the more different environments we have that are separate from each other, the better time we have at grouping prisoners together, and then the better behavior we see from the prisoners.
Pretrial prisoners will be housed separately in a special management unit. Schmidt says a pretrial facility is operated differently than a medium security unit. Corrections doesn't like to mix pretrial and sentenced prisoners. The emotional makeup of pretrial prisoners disrupts the flow of the sentence facility, he says.
They're separated from each other, so we don't have one infecting the other.
More violent prisoners will be kept in a separate unit built with actively dangerous prisoners in mind. Again, there'll be two to a cell. These prisoners will have toilet facilities in the cell, unlike the medium security inmates who will use a common dorm-like bathroom and shower. The medium security prisoners will be given the freedom to perform some daily tasks, like picking up their own mail. Prisoners will be expected to work in the prison kitchen and laundry and to help with grounds upkeep. Inmates can make between 30 and 64 cents an hour and can put that money toward purchasing their own 13-inch TV for their cells. Security is priority and is state-of-the-art. The entire campus can be viewed from a control room in a towering observation post. 800 cameras monitor the interior and exterior of the prison, according to Lee Sherman, Deputy Director of Institutions for the Corrections Department.
So if someone is wanting to go through a door and they hit the intercom, that is going to cue that camera to come up on the monitor so that the officer here can see who's at that door and maybe who's standing behind that person, too, to make sure that it's okay to open that door and let them through.
Prison guards will not be armed and corrections staff will not be carrying keys. Instead, they'll be using an innovative system which allows individual staffers access to only specific keys.
It's biometric. You put your thumb on it, enter your PIN number. It will allow you access only to your key set.
Schmidt says 95% of prisoners get out of jail during their lifetimes. The average sentence is 160 days. And so the prison program puts emphasis on preparing inmates for release.
You can do all the program in the world, but without a good reentry plan, it's for naught. And the reentry plan, part of that is follow-up, treatment follow-up. You can go through a treatment program, but without follow-up after you get out of jail, it probably isn't going to work. We know that through a lot of studies that we've looked at. So we have a strong program plan here for prisoners to correct themselves, if you will, while they're here.
Goose Creek offers inmates a vocational rehabilitation plan and computer and job skills training if the inmate behaves. Schmidt says even the maximum security prisoners can work their way into medium security depending on behavior. Starting next March, 30 minimum security inmates will be brought into Goose Creek to test the facility. The new prison still has hurdles to jump. An audit on prison expenses requested by the Senate Finance Committee is underway, based on concerns by some legislators about costs to the state for its operation. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The Pollock Bee season closed last Tuesday, and now the final harvest numbers are out. More than 1.16 million metric tons of pollock were caught in the Bering Sea this year. That's enough to make more than 3 billion boxes of fish sticks. Even though that sounds like a lot of fish, this wasn't a great year for the pollock fleet. Many boats were fishing right up to the season's end in hopes of catching their quota, and some vessels gave up on that prospect altogether. According to Josh Keaton with the National Marine Fisheries Service, that makes this an unusual year.
In the normal year, the pollock fishery harvest their entire quota. This year, due to reasons unknown, the pollock fishery was unable to harvest their entire pollock quota and left about 63,000 metric tons in the water.
This year, fishermen were allowed to catch 1.23 million metric tons of pollock, a big boost over the past few years' level. They ended up harvesting about 95% of that. Keaton says that the amount of pollock in the Bering Sea has gone up, but
they just weren't as concentrated as they normally were. It takes a lot longer to tow to get the same amount of pollock than in a normal year.
Meanwhile, a slow pollock season could be good news for other fisheries. By regulation, only 2 million metric tons of groundfish can be taken out of the Bering Sea each year, with pollock making up the bulk of that. Keaton says if the pollock quota goes down, then fisheries like Pacific cod and rockfish could get a boost.
With pollock tack not being completely taken, I believe that gives other gear groups, other, you know, fishery sectors, an ability to get more quota if they can show that they can use it.
Next week, scientists will be meeting in Seattle to discuss next year's harvest levels.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
Alaska's Supreme Court will hear a case at a Fairbanks high school next month. The December 5th hearing for a local case will be held at Lathrop High School as part of a program called Supreme Court Live. Justice Daniel Winifrey says the program offers students the opportunity to see the justice system in action.
A real live case with real live attorneys and real live parties, and our court will be there, and high school kids from all around the area will be coming to watch.
Winifrey says the case to be heard at Lathrop involves a false arrest claim and an alleged civil rights violation. He says after listening to oral arguments December 5th, students will also get to talk with attorneys and justices.
It gives the kids a chance to learn about our branch of government. They hear a lot about the legislature. They hear a lot about the executive branch through the governor. They don't often hear about what we do. And it gives them an opportunity to see us at work and know what our one-third of the rail of government is all about. And that's a real important goal for our court, and we'd like to have as many kids as possible come out and see us.
The Supreme Court Live program has been held twice in Anchorage and once in Juneau in the 3 years since it was started by Chief Justice Walter Carpinetti. A lot of people come to Sitka for the scenery, the culture, and especially the fishing. Almost no one goes there just to run, but that may change. The current issue of the Canadian counterpart of Running magazine has listed Sitka among 9 international destinations not to be missed by travelers looking for both adventure and fitness. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Sitka's made this kind of list before. It's been recognized as a cultural destination by National Geographic, and from time to time gets some press for its amazing location, which rolls together much of what Alaskans like about this state into one compact package. But running? Really?
One of the ideas that I had with this piece was to give our readers a sense of the unsung running destinations, places that they may not have heard of or may not have considered, but are legitimate running holiday destinations.
That's Mihira Lakshman, the editor-in-chief of Canadian Running. Lakshman assigned the story to freelance writer Paola Lorigio and left the rest to her.
When she approached me with her ideas for what the destinations would be and included Sitka, Alaska, I thought Alaska would be a great fit. And, you know, runners are a different breed. We tend to explore that unexplored territory and enjoy it.
Lorigio generated a story with 8 destinations besides Sitka that runners should put on their bucket lists. If my bucket ever gets big enough, I'll certainly be on my way to Bergen, Norway, Buenos Aires, Argentina, Cape Breton, Nova Scotia, Flinders Island, Australia, Moab, Utah, Moshi, Tanzania, Picton, Ontario, and Seoul, South Korea. In an email, Lorigio explained that what caught her eye first about Sitka was the fact that the Great Alaskan Marathon Cruise called here. To learn more, she called up Christine Horan, who for the last 18 years has organized Sitka's Alpine Adventure Run. Horan says Lorigio asked her what would sell Sitka to runners.
And the first thing out of my mouth was our amazing trail system that we have here, and along with the uniqueness of the town of Sitka, which I thought was an incredible fit.
The Alpine Adventure Run began as an Eagle Scout project by Horan's son in 1994 and has since evolved into one of Alaska's premier endurance events. The race is noteworthy for its climb from sea level to 2,100 feet, with most of that coming in the first mile and a half. The entire course is only a little over 7 miles, but runners get 2.5 hours to complete it, more than enough time for a typical recreational runner to finish a half marathon. But Horan says her racers wouldn't really be called typical.
A lot of our runners are not your traditional road runners. They are guys or gals out there that are wanting to be in shape for the hunting season. So we get a wide variety of runners.
A picture of one of this year's top finishers, Stephen McIntyre, a former Sitka High cross-country standout, accompanies the article in Canadian Running. It was taken by Don Cluding, the captain of Sitka's mountain rescue team, whom Horan cites as a critical element of the success of the event. With a blazing finish time of just over an hour, McIntyre is probably not among those trying to shed a few pounds for hunting season. Although a few hardcore runners from around Alaska come to Sitka just for the Alpine Adventure Race, it remains to be seen whether any of Canadian Running's 150,000 monthly readers will be lured in by the town's prominent placement with other world destinations. Editor-in-Chief Lakshman says it's really about giving his audience a way to think differently about their sport.
You know, we didn't want to simply approach it by saying, hey, you want to go to New York? Well, go run through Central Park, or go to London and try and do the London Marathon course or something like that. We wanted something that was a little bit, you know, off the beaten path, and a little bit that would give our readers something that they hadn't read before.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Anchorage has recorded more than 10 inches of snow since Saturday in a series of short but intense storms. Plows around the city are working hard to keep the roads clear, and cross-country skiers are excited to have such good coverage early in the season. Early November snow is not unusual in Anchorage, and National Weather Service meteorologist Dan Peterson says even the amount isn't particularly remarkable. But Peterson says the weather pattern right now is just right for snow.
When we get storms coming in from the southwest up the inlet, we get hit with it. That's why we're getting it.
And Peterson says it's a pattern that won't let up anytime soon.
All the way through next week, on and off, we'll be getting snow.
The forecast calls for snow showers tonight, clearing tomorrow, and then a chance of snow again on Wednesday. The National Weather Service is also tracking a massive storm expected to hit most of Alaska's west coast tomorrow night. The storm is forecast to produce major coastal flooding and erosion, high winds, and as much as 14 inches of snow in some areas. The National Weather Service is calling the storm extremely dangerous and life-threatening, and predicting it could be one of the worst on record for Alaska's west coast. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, Jennifer Canfield in Kodiak, Ellen Lockyer in the Mat-Su Valley, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
And by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.